land in as much as Scotland. I'm going to share the story of my family up until my grandfather's time and how their connection to the land impacted on them and continues to impact on us as a family. We might be getting the picture. That slide is, it's a photograph of my great-grandmother, great-grandfather, and they had eight children, and there are images of three of their girls and my grandfather, and those three girls were trafficked to Canada. And it's a century ago now, but what I want to try and demonstrate here is how that stays with a family and speak a bit about, and I'm no expert on this and it's all quite new thinking, but about intergenerational trauma and how that impacts your DNA. And by DNA, I don't mean that it changes your DNA, but it changes how your DNA is read and triggered. So the term's epigenetics. But I'm not going to go into that today because I don't know enough about it. I'm not a scientist. But, you know, Google it if you're interested. It's a really, and it's quite different from what's known as cultural trauma, which is seen as collective trauma, if you like, that Aboriginal and Indigenous people take with them through the generations. And it's the basic, my understanding, the thinking around that is, you know, I can share another gypsy traveller's trauma, even though I haven't directly experienced it because I'm part of that group or culture. But this intergenerational trauma is new thinking now, and it's about the person. So my trauma, you know, one of you people in the audience might be part of a member of the same tribe as me, but you can empathise with my trauma, but you couldn't own it, and it wouldn't become part of your DNA or family makeup because it's to me, and it comes down the generations. Oh look, I have spent a lot of time in the past year speaking to Aboriginal elders about how they deal with intergenerational trauma and how is it possible to move on from that. And I spent some time speaking to an Aboriginal elder guy who explained to me that we have to accept, speaking about me here, my generation, I have to accept and own anything that's passed on to my children and grandchildren, because by me sharing what happened to us in the past, like I'm doing today, I am continuing that trauma and that impact on their epigenetics and how they're perhaps always in fight or flight mode. So speaking to him, he told me that the way to deal with that is have a final, almost like ceremonial telling of the trauma, of my trauma, my family's trauma, and so it go, and then put it to bed, and so it's almost like catharsis. So that's what I'm doing today. So I'd like to thank you all for sitting here and listening to that. So I'm not going to go into everything about the story, but I'm just going to tell you the key points of the story so you can get a feel for how deep it went with us and why it's still continued. And we have some of the pictures here. My great-grandmother Elizabeth is kind of out of tune. That was my great-grandfather. It's not coming, but if it comes back up... So this is Grace, Gracie, Mary and Margaret. That's the only photograph we have of Margaret because she died quite young. And the guy in the uniform is my grandfather, John. who kept the family trade of basket making going, and I've continued that as well. I'm no nearly as good as them. I wouldn't attempt to sell any of my baskets to anybody. I don't think I would get any buyers. Plus, I would have to charge you £200 because it takes me days to make them. But there you go. So, yeah. To start, the story actually almost starts in Glasgow. And I'm going to read, put my reading glasses on. I'm going to start with reading you some quotes from Gypsies and travellers always experienced some sort of discrimination or prejudice. We always have throughout the centuries. A lot of that's just been fear of the unknown. And there's been various attempts over the centuries to move them on, to put them into areas where we couldn't be seen. Certain groups of gypsies and travellers had a bit more acceptance than others. My family history is I'm not a Scottish traveller or an Akan. I'm Irish and Manoush. So that, and we came over to Scotland and moved around the Scottish border area and became part of that group that's sometimes named so or was known as the Border Gypsies. And our family intermarried with some Scottish Nakan and married across the border also. So we've got quite a widespread and quite a lot of Scottish traveller names down the line. But so anyway, what I want to do to speak about the family here is it all started really, I think it was the green light was given to people to be openly hostile towards gypsies and travellers and to take action to deal with gypsies and travellers. It stemmed from a House of Commons debate which took place on the 15th of June in 1894. And it was discussing, it was a Mr. Paul of Edinburgh asked the Secretary of State for Scotland, or the Secretary for Scotland, who was George Otto Trevelyan then, back in the day, of his constituency was Glasgow, Bridgeton, so that's the kind of link there. About the setting up of a committee to inquire into the alleged increase in the number of habitual offenders in some parts of Scotland, and gypsies and travellers were included in that, and to the deficient means of coping with this evil. George Trevelyan went on to say he'd considered the subject of vagrants, beggars and inebriates and resolved to appoint a departmental committee to inquire and report upon it. And a year later, 20th May 1895, that report was tabled in the House of Commons. It was over almost 800 pages long. I have read in some cases that it was all about gypsies and travellers, and it wasn't. The whole almost 800 pages were not specifically just about gypsies and travellers, because, you know, there are many people that were classed in this report as vagrants or delinquents or however you want to use the term that was used back in the day. But gypsies and travellers are threaded throughout that report, but mainly determined as being vagrants. I want to read, it's important, I think, to read this. It's quite a long excerpt, so feel free to close your eyes and sit back and just listen in, but I think it's important to hear. This is evidence that's included in report and was a huge part and informed the outcomes and conclusions of the report from a Mr. William Mitchell Esquire, member of the Glasgow School Board, speaking about what was described as for gypsies and travellers, or travellers, the word tinker was used, and it was quite an acceptable word to use back in the day. It was related to, it being seen as tinkering or working with tin, and of course it's not an acceptable term now. So, from the wonderful, cold-hearted Mr. William Mitchell Esquire, I may say that my evidence with regards to the tinkers, as I call them, because they're quite different a class from the gypsies, has reference to those in Perthshire and north of Perthshire. I live for 6 weeks every summer in Perthshire in very close contact with this class because they are just around about my house where I live in Pitlochry. And I'm impressed with the awfully destitute and degraded condition in which the children are being brought up. At Pitlochry, Sergeant Small is the most intelligent witness who can give you information such as I hope you will receive. The evil of the gypsies and travellers is increasing to my knowledge and has been for 10 or 12 years. He's asked if he has any suggestions as to how the children of such classes, such as those in Perthshire, can be dealt with. And he answers that with regards to those in the north, and keep this in mind, this guy constantly mentions those in the north in Perthshire, where he obviously has a holiday home, although it probably wasn't called that at the time. I have one or two very important suggestions. The first that I would make is this. I understand that both landlords and tenants have the power to give them permission to strike their tents without interference on their land. I think when it is proved to satisfaction that it is both an insanitary dwelling and an immoral dwelling, and that the children are living under such conditions from year to year, as I have described, that no tenant or landlord should be allowed to give them permission and thus encourage them to live in the manner they live there. That's my first remedy. My second remedy is this, that all such movable dwellings should be registered and brought under the control of the local authority for inspection. And where on inspection they were found so utterly insanitary and indecent as to be unfit for human habitation, they should be closed, and that where no other provision existed for housing, by local authority or parish council or whoever should be the proper party, there should be provided in the nearest villages refuges to which they might go. That's really important if any of you, and I know there are some people here that will have read about or indeed know some of the people that live at Bobbin Mill round about Pitlochry, which is, if you Google Tinker Experiment, you'll find that Seamus and Rosanna McPhee still live there, and a couple of generations ago their family were, well, they had to go there, they were told they had to go there, Perth and Kinross. It's something to keep in mind, and indeed they're still there and still waiting for an apology for what their families have experienced over the almost a century. They should be told that they cannot remain there any longer, and this could be provided for up to 1 or 2 years. Their children will be looked after and sent to school, and the whole Tinker clan thus gradually brought into association with the other labourers with whom they were already, to a certain extent, in touch. So that's where we start to hear the rumblings of assimilation, enforced assimilation. A final comment from him. And when I first read this, I had to read it twice because I thought, surely not, but yes. Have you any other suggestions, Mr. Mitchell has asked. Well, at the moment, I am not prepared to say more. I thought you'd be taking evidence on this subject afterwards, but these are my two principal remedies. My object is to have them extirpated, which eradicated is a more modern word for that, as a class, and absorbed into the labouring population, assimilation. That is the purpose I have in view. I think it is absolutely necessary and should be done. So that's going back to 1895, but that is the beginnings of, you know, it's written down, and this is all in Hansard. It is there, that it's an official government report that suggests, and in fact, I'm thinking of the word here, it suggests, but also gives people the power, if you like, to work to start to eradicate gypsies and travellers from Scottish society. Fast forward to, there you go, the family. Fast forward to 1910. Now, my family, as I mentioned earlier, were in the borders, and for some reason, Mr. Mitchell and other people seemed to think that, as they described as Southern Gypsies, they seemed to be creating a class all by themselves. They seemed to think that the Southern Gypsies were okay-ish, and they sent their children to school, and they were not so bad. But it's these pesky ones up in Perth and Perthshire and further into the Highlands, which I'm always tempted to suspect that that was where they went holidaying, so they really just didn't want to be looking at gypsies and travellers. We're assuming that there wasn't enough work. They couldn't find work in their usual route, so they decided to go up there. Who knows? They weren't with the whole family. The older girls, some were away and one married. The other brother, Francis, he was away working the cranes in the Americas, allegedly. And so they were up there with my grandfather, John, and the three girls, so Gracie, Mary and Margaret. And Gracie was 6 at the time, so it was a really small child, and there wasn't much between them. My grandfather and my great-grandfather were off working, doing whatever they were doing. And what was known then as the cruelty man, which was the inspector who had power then to instruct people to go to poor houses. They had the power in law to instruct them and could take them to a poor house for up to 7 days. Went to the roadside camp and instructed Elizabeth and her three girls to go to the poor house. I have all this on record, so although it's a story, it's a fact. Took them, it was Mr. Mackenzie, took them to the poor house and had Elizabeth sign over the three girls to Quarrier Homes in Bridge of Weir. Her signature is with an X mark because she was illiterate. And so off the girls went. When the men came back, Elizabeth was distraught, but thought that she could have these, she could go back, I've made a mistake, or that, you know, we could have the girls back. But that wasn't to be the case. We have records. We had the priest in Innerlethen, which is where the family lived when they weren't shifting, wrote to Quarriers. A scholar teacher woman who lived at an address on High Street in Peebles, which, as an aside and a wee bit of tangent, I later found out when I was showing these records to my husband that that was the house where his family, who came over from Italy, lived. So we had this, it's really strange how things happen. So way back the generations, we had this connection, but that's me going off at a tangent. So, had letters that the priest had written and said, the children are Catholic, you shouldn't have them, we'll have to have them back. The answer from Miss Quarrier was, show me their marriage papers. There were no marriage papers because they weren't married in the sort of normal terminology. There's lists and lists from Quarrier's journals of all the communications between and across. And my grandfather, who was literate, he wrote, there's records of letters being, back in the day you could go to a post office and get a letter sent for you. Letter went from Carnwath post office, which is just outside, which is near Lanark, all to no avail. And the final communication, this went on up until, the girls were there for just over 3 years. And the final communication was from my great-grandfather, who by this time was using an address in Pennycook, asking again for the return or at least information about his daughters. And the response was all sent to Canada in May 2013. So they didn't know, they hadn't been told that the girls had been sent. They'd just been sent. So I use the word trafficked because that's what this was. Quarriers, and it wasn't just quarriers that did this. Bernardo's did it. There was, I think it was a Mary McPherson Children's Homes or whatever. There was quite a few did it. But I was reading a bit about how the Orphan Homes of Scotland, which is quarriers, were complimented because they were able to, you know, they offered best value with these children because they were able to traffic them overseas for £12, whereas other ones were charging £15. So, you know, capitalism back in the days as well. So the three girls were shipped off to Canada. They were separate. They were taken to Quarriers Fair Now Home up at Brockville in Ontario, where they were held until it was a bit of a cattle market. Families came and chose who they would like and who they wouldn't like. I've never been able to find out what happened to children that nobody wanted. If you had children with a disability or children that were ill or just people just didn't like the look of them. I've spoken to some people and we've had our suspicions that they may have ended up in the residential schools that were used for First Nations children when they were removed. And as you'll know if you read the news, that there's been a lot of graves found, unmarked graves, and, you know, so nobody would know if there was children in there. So they were separated. Margaret was 14 at the time, so she went straight into service, and she managed to meet a fellow Scot who had been sent over as well. There was Mars ships that children used to be sent away on. She married him, but she still died young. And Mary went to a family of Walter and Aid Smith. Mary was really upset and worried about her younger sister, who was really, really young. And Walter Smith did some digging and found out that she was with a family in Ottawa. And he went there and, as I mentioned earlier, found her working as a servant at that age to a wealthy white settler family. So it's not known what this guy said to the people, but he came home with her. So Grace and Mary grew up in that family. Now, Walter and Aid gave them a really good life, and they went to school. They both became teachers. They had a good life. Gracie lived to 99, but they didn't have the life they should have had. And if my grandfather and my father hadn't kept digging, they would never have known about us, and we would never have made that connection either. So we would always have had something missing. We knew that they'd been trafficked. They didn't. They knew they'd been taken from home because they were old enough to remember that. But they didn't know. They didn't know how to get back in contact with us. They'd also had a surname change by the time they got out there, which made it a bit difficult to connect with them. And I'm going to finish this story about them just with as. I'm still in contact with Gracie's remaining daughter, regularly Zoom with her, Leslie. And she always speaks about, her mother would never speak about her time in Quarriers Homes. She just wouldn't. It was a horrendous experience for her. We know that, you know, there's a lot of abuse went on there back in the day. But what she would speak about is, she had one memory, she had a scar in her forearm, and she told her mother that that was when it was a spark at a camp, at a fire, stick fire. She spoke about that, but she also said that she felt that her older brother, my grandfather John, had abandoned her. That's what she'd felt when she spent time in Quarriers Home and on her journey over, and in her younger years when she was first out in Canada. And I think it's horrendously sad that a small child spent those years thinking that, not that it was out of our family's hands what had happened to her, but that our family had abandoned her, especially this brother who she must have looked up to. And she felt that, she used to say that to Leslie, that she just really, she knew when she was older that that wasn't the case, but she felt in her younger and sad times that her brother had left her. And it's so, so sad. And it makes me feel sad. And you know, sometimes when you could be sitting watching something on the television, or you could be listening to a bit of music or something, and it just comes into your head. And everything about it was horrendous. But the worst thing to me is thinking about those three children, and they were sent in a party, I think it was 83, them getting put on board a ship, and probably, I don't know what the classes are on a ship, because I've never been on a ship, but I would imagine it for 12 quid, you know, they wouldn't have been at the top with the portholes and the windows. Imagine what must have been in their heads on that trip, and then arriving in this strange country, and then getting shipped again, and then getting herded out for people to come and choose them. Although I'm using this opportunity today to give me closure and stop speaking about it, I don't think those thoughts would ever leave you, because it's the fact that they were children. And that's how children were treated. But for me, because we were gypsies and travellers, it was even more acceptable to do it. And they didn't even feel that they had to let their family members know that the girls were no longer in the country. And I think that's what will always stay with me. I think to kind of turn it around, to go back to the connection to the land, I suppose for me, it's that whole thing about, I don't know what it is that makes you still have to always be nomadic, always be shifting to some sort of degree. But if you've had such trauma in your life, you know, losing your children, yet you're still driven to shift, which is the word we use for moving and nomadism up in Scotland, to keep doing that, to still look for work, have a base, but still keep shifting, still keep doing your traditional crafts. What, it has to be something, it has to be the land, it has to be, my family's traditional trade is basket making, as I mentioned, and that, we harvest, you know, you have to harvest the willow before the sap comes up, you know, so you have to know the land, and you have to know the seasons and when it's right to harvest the tools of your trade. And maybe it's because we were so close to the land, because without it and what the land gave us, we wouldn't be able to exist. We wouldn't be able to look after our family. And maybe that's something that just never leaves you. It'll never leave me. I've taught my grandchildren now to make baskets. So they don't need to do it, but they know how to do it. And they also know through their father about the land and how to use the land and how to live on the land. And they still have, I don't live far. I live in a house now with a small garden, so I don't think my neighbours would like it if I had a stick fire out the back every night. But, you know, they're lucky. They live up in the Highlands, so they have their stick fires and they've got their chitty irons, as well, you know, the pot and the irons. And so they have all that and they can still do that. And it's just thinking that's what the culture used to be. I think I'm just going to leave it at that, and just, you know, if anybody wants to ask me anything, because I want to thank you for allowing me to share this today and you know, to move it on as well. But I'm just going to give the floor to anybody that wants to ask me anything. Thank you.